Hey guys, don't forget to check out the Street Cop Training Conference 2023, April 23rd through the 28th, Nashville, Tennessee. The Gaylord at Opry, what a center, what a place. We have amazing speakers, amazing training, five of the most impactful days of your career. Check it out at streetcop.com. You do not want to miss out. There is a room code available for a discounted room. Sign up now at streetcop.com. Hey guys, welcome to this episode of the Street Cop Training Podcast. I'm your host, founder and CEO of Street Cop Training. My name is Dennis Bonino, and I have with me today a very special guest. Very thankful for him to be here. It is none other than Dr. Trevor Wilkins, and I'll let him tell you a little bit about who he is and what he's up to. Let's go into your 90-second bio of who you are. Tell the world.
So what I do now is I'm a licensed mental health therapist in central Kentucky. I have an office here, kind of a traditional office. And what we specialize there is complex PTSD, high-risk careers, and adults with childhood trauma. So because the high-risk careers part, of course, that tracks a lot of public safety, military, emergency nurses, doctors, people that, you know, just deal with high stress, high risk. The reason I got into that is I spent 15 years uniform law enforcement, and I'll be glad to tell the story of how that all came falling down. But I spent 15 years in uniform law enforcement. At the end, I was in a really bad place, went to a couple of different people that said they could help. Unfortunately, they were nice people, good therapists probably, but they didn't understand me and my anger and my type A personality. The first lady that I went to that was recommended to me as a therapist, she cried when I told her kind of the story that started the demise of my law enforcement career. So you become the helper. That's not good. It's okay to show some compassion with your and some emotion with your clients or your patients, but that didn't work for me. And then the second gentleman that I went to, great guy, still send families and stuff to him now because that's his specialty. But he said, Trevor, your anger and your PTSD are so bad. I don't know what to do with you and I don't know where to send you. So, you know, this was multiple strikes on my willingness to kind of reach out there in the first place, which none of us, of course, like to do. And I realize now after doing this for so long that they just didn't understand. They just didn't understand that the traditional routes weren't going to work for me. You know, trauma is trauma. True trauma affects everybody's brain in a similar way. But when you see it as much as we do, when you start to assimilate that, and that becomes your filter over life, they didn't really understand. Read a little better about it. But they didn't understand me. So for me, after this fall, and again, I'll be, you know, glad to talk about it. Doesn't bother me anymore. But after this fall from law enforcement and dealing with that, those individuals, I'm kind of bullheaded or thick-skulled, whatever my wife says. And I just decided, well, I'm going to go to school and figure this out. I had no degree when I started. I went to college all the way through a PhD, just kind of grinded it out. And so in counseling is what I did it in and became this licensed counselor. And I really did it to fix me. Everything was falling apart. I was in a really bad place. I call those the dark years. I really did it to fix me. What the heck is wrong with me? You know, kind of like police, we're just willing to go figure out what's going on here and drive forward. So my willingness to do it for me was strong. And I got there and definitely learned some things, but it turned into a pretty cool job later. So not only do I get to help my people, you know, and we have plenty of civilians at our office as well. I've got people that come in, they're just dealing with trauma or complex cases, or some other therapist will send them to us when the case is getting complex. But now it's become a pretty cool job. I get to do things like this interview. I get to travel a lot and speak about public safety, mental health, about high risk mental health, about high stress job mental health. I've traveled probably 28 days out of the month this year. Which I enjoy doing. So it's led to some pretty neat things for me, but being able to kind of either pay that forward or help those around me continues to help me as well. I continue to grow because, like I said earlier about your program, I constantly want to get better. I constantly want to learn new things to get better at my craft, as a good cop would do. So it continues to heal me on a regular basis. I'm nothing like I used to be. And what that finally turned into as well, which is gets more of the kind of social media and national notoriety, is I can only do therapy where I'm at. And so I thought but I was getting calls from all over the U.S. of people that needed help, cops specifically, that wanted to talk to a cop. And there's a few of us out there, not many, but there's some of us out there. Maybe they had seen a YouTube video of mine, or maybe somebody had recommended them to me. They heard me speak at a conference or a seminar, and they wanted to talk to me. So I wanted to figure out a way that I could help A, more people, but B, the people that weren't in my area. So it turned into this, what's essentially an education and coaching program, because we can't do therapy outside the state. What became this coaching and lifestyle and education program, and it's named the Angry Viking Therapist Mindset. And the reason it's that is in academia, as you know, may well know, or your listeners know, academia is pretty left. They don't look a lot like me, and they don't talk a lot like me, and they not a lot of them like cops a whole lot. So just because of my appearance, my right arm is covered in Viking tattoos. That's a big history fan thing of mine. I'm big into that era. And because of the beard and the mohawk, they named me the Angry Viking Therapist in college. So it just kind of stuck. It became a trademark for me. And that's what became this online program where people can come in at different tiers, whatever they need. And you're getting daily information, daily check-ins to make sure that you're doing the things that you're supposed to be doing. But it also has things like weekly Q&A calls, weekly one-on-ones for the higher tiers. So, never to be a salesman. I don't want to be a salesman, but that's kind of where I am now with mental health. I've got the office here in Central Kentucky that I continue to do the traditional therapy. And then I'm able to reach out and help the people like me through this online program that were calling constantly and saying they need help, or they had gone to a therapist, or they wanted to talk to me specifically just because of my background. And what I get, I call it borrowed credit. You know, when an officer comes in, or a fireman comes in, or EMS, or military, or even emergency nurse, or just somebody that deals with high risk and high stress like that, and trauma, you know, when they come in and say, try to tell a story about a shooting or an injury wreck, I don't know their shooting, I don't know their injury wreck, but I know shootings and injury wrecks. So I would never pretend to understand exactly what they're going through. I would never use those words. But I think it gives people some comfort, because I would have gotten comfort from that. It gives people some comfort of, no, at least this guy's been there. He doesn't know my story. He doesn't know my supervisor I'm struggling with. He doesn't know my family, but he's been there. And that's why I'm willing to go out and tell kind of my story across the nation, as embarrassing as it can be, this fall from law enforcement. Because what I find repeatedly in this is that people will come up and say, man, it's like you were talking about me. And I tell them, it's because I was talking about me. We're all kind of a mess, you know. So much more of the 90-second spiel there, but I'm not very good at the elevator pitch. But that's where I'm at now. That's kind of how I got to where I'm at, and that's what I'm doing as a psychotherapist now.
You have two other therapists at your office, is that correct?
Mm-hmm. I do. Yep.
Tell me about them.
One of them was actually not connected to public safety much at all, and I brought Meredith on to be one that could take the clients that maybe weren't a fit for me. And again, you don't have to be a cop or military, or I'm just kind of a type A personality. I know I'm not for everybody. Meredith's fairly type A too, but she's a little more of a generalist when it comes to dealing with psychotherapy. So she's able to see, and she sees plenty of cops too, and does an outstanding job at it. But initially the idea was to bring her in to kind of get the other people that may not kind of fit who I was talking to, but we still want to provide services to, because we are trauma specialists. So that was initially the idea. Well, I was gone 1 week, and an officer needed to be seen pretty much immediately. And I said, listen, I wouldn't have hired her if she wasn't a competent therapist. She's great at trauma. You know, that's our specialty. She trained under me as well as some other places. And the officer went to her, and she loved it, and he loved it. And so we no longer kind of separate, oh, well, you're working in public safety, let's get you with Trevor. It's, who do you want to see? You've read their bios, who are you comfortable with? Maybe one of us has an opening before the other does. And so now, you know, you learn those things as a business owner. What was kind of my initial idea to bring her in is she's been a great addition to the office. Kelly was not a public safety member herself. She was the director of the crisis response board for the state. So she has extensive experience, more years than I even, extensive experience dealing with critical events, traumas. They would go out to anything from tornadoes to an earthquake to a major fire, you know, that took out an area. Well, what she was in charge of, and what I don't want to speak for, but I think she prided herself the most in, was the Kentucky LEAP program that fell under them, which is the law enforcement assistance program. So she's a therapist, has been for a long time. So she's extensively practiced in dealing with public safety members, especially in crisis, and kind of the follow-up from that. So I always tell people I stole both of them from other agencies, and we're just rocking and rolling now. I do have another person in my office, Reg, but he's working part-time right now. The reason I bring him up is his background's really neat. He was a 34, 37-year Air Force veteran. He got out as a colonel, retired as a colonel, and then started doing mental health. I kind of love those stories of second career mental health people, because they bring something to the table, you know, that a 22-year-old who may be an excellent therapist may not be able to bring in that experience, the life experience, the military or public safety experience. He's working part-time right now doing some other things, so he's not advertised on the website, but it's a great, great group of people. I still need to add more. I'm very fortunate, you know, in the 7 or 8 years of growth that we've had, I still need to hire more people. I can't hire fast enough, which is great.
Do you find it hard to find quality candidates of this type to fit what you're trying to do? I mean, obviously there's therapists that exist, and I have a follow-up question to that once you answer that one.
Yeah. Now the therapy world's going to hate hearing this, and the educational world's going to hate hearing this, but yeah, I do find it extremely difficult to find candidates that, and it's not even the public safety side, because I'm not so specific about hiring somebody that's been there, done that. That's really hard to find. But to find a trauma therapist, somebody that's trauma-informed, that's good at trauma, and continues to follow up on training, continues to find new methodologies, continues to get better, that's the employee that I want. I want the one who's continuously asking questions, making themselves better, going back and reading when maybe they faced something that they didn't understand in the office. There are so many therapists today, and again, that community is going to hate to hear it, but they know it's true. There's so many therapists today that are stuck in their in the one thing that they learn, and this is definitely going to make the difference. Everybody's different. Yeah, trauma affects the brain in similar ways for everybody, but you got to keep learning. You got to keep getting better at your craft. That's what's hard to find when I'm hiring people.
I think that's overall a tough thing to find in general. When you say progressing and looking for new things, have you heard of brain spotting?
I have. I can't say I know a lot about brain spotting. I know it's been extremely effective. The reason I know about it is I practice what's called EMDR, which is very popular these days. Eye movement desensitization reprocessing. And kind of the quick story of my EMDR education was I was doing trauma therapy, doing well with clients. And, you know, you're always hearing of new ideas. I'm always searching. And so I'd heard of this EMDR. It sounded new. It's actually been around about 30 years. It's just kind of gained popularity through social media and through us recognizing trauma more these days. So I had heard of EMDR, and the mistake I made was I got on YouTube and looked it up. And it was some weird lady waving her hand in front of people and asking them if they felt better. And I thought, nope, that's dumb. Definitely not doing that. So I was not only against it, I was almost antagonistic. People would call my office and say, it says that you're a trauma specialist. Do you do EMDR? And in those early days, I even said, like, absolutely not. That's crazy. This stuff doesn't work. It's just a placebo. Come here and get some real therapy. And I went to a seminar that we do 7 times a year here in Kentucky. They do them some across the nation, a post-critical incident seminar. It's usually 30 to 40 officers or dispatchers and their spouses that have been involved in something traumatic or critical. And in some ways identified as not doing well. Now, maybe they're not falling apart. Maybe they're just having trouble getting past this thing, or they're having nightmares. And they brought a gentleman from Georgia who now I consider a friend, who was a former trooper, become therapist. And he came up and did EMDR. And he did EMDR. And I watched in about 25 minutes what was taking me 3 months to do with people. And I was hooked. And so I started looking around for different ways to, it's an expensive education. It's definitely worth it. I know now, but looking at who can I go take a class from? Because I'm not going to that weird lady that waved her hand in front of people, you know, that that just didn't fit my type and my people. Well, I found a retired colonel in Tennessee, just outside Fort Campbell. He was actually enlisted in Vietnam, got his commission as an officer, went all the way to colonel. And he owned a company called the Soldier Center. If that doesn't tell you what they work with, you know, that's the big flag. So I had heard that he was an EMDR specialist and that he taught it. I went down there kind of dreading the price for it as a business owner, as a new business owner at the time, went down there, took the class, never looked back. It's the most amazing thing for trauma. If people aren't doing things like brain spotting or EMDR, and there's a couple of others that run on kind of the same idea of what the brain does under trauma, man, they're really missing the boat. They really are. There's absolutely a place for talk therapy. That talk therapy is still probably 50% of my day because it's life stuff that's going on, not necessarily trauma. I studied under this Dr. E.C. Hurley, who was the colonel for many years. Unfortunately, he passed away last August. To this day, I would consider him the best trauma therapist there ever was. In fact, Francine Shapiro, who created EMDR, passed away, I want to say 2 years ago now. And at the EMDR International Conference, they created a Francine Shapiro Lifetime Achievement Award in EMDR, and he was the first recipient. So that's how influential he was in creating EMDR. He wrote a book just before he passed. But man, what a great guy, somebody I hope to achieve to be like one day in the therapy world. But we lost him last year. But that was kind of my travel with EMDR. And now it's not only did it just help me deal with clients that are dealing with trauma, it changed the way that I looked at trauma, completely changed the way that I dealt with it.
We have an in-house psychotherapist here. And I don't want to say in-house because we're really not practicing anything here. She has, you know, in the beginning came on our podcast, and a very good friend. Her husband's a police officer here. And, you know, she's very good. And Hannah Heyman is steadfast and firm on her belief that brain spotting is the biggest unlock that she's ever found. And I know that EMDR and brain spotting are kind of in the same category. I'm not going to sit here.
Absolutely.
Like a professional. She actually, I think that she said within months, a trained therapist could get this brain spotting thing down if you get the training for it. I don't, maybe six months of training on this. And she said she's turning people around in 5 to 6 sessions that earlier would have taken her 30, 40 sessions. And she is having, she goes, look, when people walk into my office, my goal is to get them out of my office. I'm not sitting here trying to hold on people forever. I'm trying to get them. And, you know, some therapists are, and this is from experience too, as well.
Sure.
Will say fix. Some will say healed. There's this vernacular that's associated with everything they want to say. I've been told I'm a fixer. So when I say fix, it's, you know, I get scolded a little bit about that in sessions that I've been in, but that's, you know, I'm a fixer. I'm a business owner is what I'm supposed to do every day is come here and fix this motherfucker. So is EMDR and brain spotting a fit for everyone?
That's a great question. I would say yes in this way, that because what EMDR does is not necessarily based on individual filters that we need to fix. Now, such as talk therapy would do. You know, if your filter's consistently dark or it's consistently angry, that's something that maybe we need to deal with. Now, EMDR does fix a filter, but it fixes more of a filter of that limbic system, that fight or flight part of the brain that's constantly getting you in trouble. Mm-hmm. And the problem with that limbic system is it's an on and off switch. It's a dummy switch, I call it. We certainly need it. We absolutely need it in life. We need it in policing. We need it in public safety and military. But it's an on and off switch. It's either all the way on or all the way off. And the reason that I say that it's a fit for everybody is that your brain does the same as my brain, does the same as my wife's brain, does the same as my kid's brain when it deals with trauma. Trauma is just overwhelming to the brain. And what we know about the brain is that you constantly form these new neural pathways every time you learn something. So if you're 5 and touch the stove and it's hot, you form a neural pathway that says, don't do that anymore. That was terrible. Right? You don't have to touch the fire next week to realize it's hot too. Well, when it comes to trauma, which your brain has a lot of trouble processing, the way I like to say it, it kind of gets stuck on the right side of your brain as a raw nerve. And if you've ever had a kid fall and scrape their knee on the concrete, you don't have to touch it to make it hurt. You can blow air in its general direction. That's a raw nerve. That's where that trauma is stuck. Your brain can't figure out what to do with it during REM sleep, during rapid eye movement sleep, to get that stuff put away. So it's stuck there as a raw nerve. So the reason I say it's a fit for everybody is everybody's brain works the same when it comes to that. Now, the last chapter of Dr. Hurley, who I was just talking about, Dr. Hurley's book is when EMDR doesn't work, and it says in parentheses, for some therapists, right? It will always work in some way. Now, everybody may not achieve the same goal. Everybody may not achieve the same change. But I've never, in all these years, used EMDR that it didn't make a change in somebody's life. It doesn't make the world rainbows and unicorns. I always tell people it doesn't make bad things good. Trauma is trauma. Critical events are hard. You'll never, you may not ever unsee in some way the difficult things. You may not ever hate driving by a certain location and thinking about an event that went on there, but it no longer has to control your life. It no longer has to become that raw nerve and become that limbic system issue where you go into fight or flight. And 5 minutes later, you realize you've lost your shit for something that was minor that doesn't feel like it had anything to do with the trauma. And then we figure out that it does, right? So the brain is the brain. The limbic system is the limbic system. So it's a fit for everybody. It may not be a fit for all therapists. They may not feel comfortable with it, or I may use it too little and not be proficient in it. But it's always a fit. Now, what that outcome is, that kind of depends on the therapist and the client working together and finding the right goals. You know, if a client's not going to be open, say about childhood, and they don't have to come in and sit down and tell me horrible things right off the bat, but if we're not open to what some of this may be going back to, then it's probably not going to feel as extremely effective. There's a big difference between one critical incident, EMDR. You had a shooting 2 weeks ago and you're having trouble sleeping and you're having trouble thinking about going back to work. We're going to clear that out pretty quickly. But if that shooting left you feeling helpless and hopeless and not good enough, and you felt that way since age 4 when something bad happened, we're going to have to start a little earlier. It's not exposure therapy. We don't have to go back and talk about all that stuff. You've got the details. I don't need the details. But we're going to have to deal with the fact that you've always felt not good enough. And EMDR helps with that too. You know, it's not just critical events. It's events that leave that mark on us that the brain has never figured out what to do with. A great example this week, I was just working with somebody who's been in law enforcement for over, I think he said 37 years. And he just happened to get hurt the last year. And there he is cleaning out his office, just miserable. He wanted to stay another couple of years. You know, he's really clearly really invested in law enforcement. He was a chief of a small town and he's cleaning out his office. And we had talked about some stuff that had happened earlier in his life, and he's cleaning out his office, feeling not good enough and, you know, beat down and angry. And we got to the point where it takes a little discussion to do this, but we got to the point where I said, were you 59, you said, when you were cleaning out your office? He said, yeah. I said, what if I told you were 9? And he just dropped his head and went, yeah, exact same feeling. Exact same feeling as 9 when that horrible thing happened to me. Exact same feeling. Because the brain doesn't know the difference of what the stimulus is. And finally, what I like to tell people, the reason it's a fit is because it doesn't make trauma go away. It doesn't make bad things good. It never will. Any therapist that tells you that, you should get out of there. But it just takes the emotional overreaction from it. And I took this from an officer here that I worked with, giving me permission to use it. He was involved in a shooting. It was pretty difficult. It was a textbook shooting, but it was very difficult. There's family there and a lot going on, a lot of chaos. And he said, what EMDR did was it took it from right here in color every day to back here in black and white. So of course he can bring it up and he can drive by that place and see it and think about it. And he doesn't like to think about it, but it's just not there every day anymore. You know, it's not a constant thought of, oh my gosh, helpless. We're helpless here. We're hopeless here. This is all going wrong. This is, you know, for a lot of people, a shooting or a critical event like that is the first time that they've truly felt out of control, like really out of control. And in my professional opinion, that's what causes you the problem. You know, it's, yeah, the event is bad, whether you're 3 or 13 or 30 or 50, the event is bad. But it's when your brain said, we're out of control here. We can't handle this. Now you've got a problem, right? If that starts early in life, you may not have put together the skills like a lot of us learn to deal with trauma. And so it just continues to build. I like to say it just keeps adding shit to the shit pile. You know, if you started out of shit, you're still living in Shitsville, it just adds to the shit pile. So, or maybe you had a bad car wreck and you're afraid to go across a bridge. You know, we can deal with that too.
What happens when people start packing trauma down, hiding it away, storing it, not addressing it, compartmentalizing it, ignoring it? How does that create neural pathways? But what's the essential detriment of not dealing with significant traumas like that, maybe over and over and over again, maybe a very difficult childhood with all sorts of traumatic things occurring and, you know, just trying to go into that survivor mode? What happens then as you go into adulthood?
I think there's a couple of ways to look at that problem. So in my therapist's mind, there's trauma and there's daily functioning problems, right? So the trauma part, what that causes is that you're never processing it. Now, you can't force your brain to process something, but this is all predicated on the understanding that what happens in the third stage of sleep, the rapid eye movement, your eyes are moving, they're not looking at anything. Your eyelids are closed. We have this really cool design that when our eyes are moving, it's stimulating both hemispheres of the brain. It's actually one of the few times in when you're alive that you can use both hemispheres at the same time. And what's happening, since they're both moving and it's stimulating both sides, is that I talked about that raw nerve that's stuck on the right side. That's the chaos side of the brain. It's all the incoming information. It's all the stuff that happens today. That this conversation for people is going in there. How they got to their favorite restaurant is going in there. What they like to order there. Trauma also goes in there. So you go to this third stage of sleep, and what happens is it's taking all the information from that right side and putting it on the left side, which is the logic side. And I like to describe the logic side as 2 + 2 = 4, whether you like it or not. It's just over there. It's just a thing. It doesn't matter if you love math or hate math or despise math. It's just a thing. There's a shelf over there for how to change a flat tire. You didn't drive in today thinking about how to change a flat tire. It's just over there, unemotional. I'll deal with it when I need to deal with it. Well, what shelf do you put hurt kids on? You know, we're not made for a shelf like that. Now, there is one, but we need to do a little work, whether through REM sleep, whether through EMDR, whether through rational therapy, whatever we need to do to get that stuff put away. So it's not the raw nerve anymore. That's what happens is the brain can't figure out what to do with it. So it stays as that raw nerve, and anything will flick that raw nerve. So I say that because I think probably, I don't want to speak for them, but most psychologists would hate this statement. They'll tell you that compartmentalization is a terrible way to do business. And maybe it is, but I'll tell you in our profession, compartmentalization is a necessity. You can't go to one call and not go to the next one. It just doesn't work like that. So to say never compartmentalize, as some therapists will tell you, that they don't do what we do. You have to. You absolutely have to put this one away and go to the next one. Because dealing with the trauma at this one, when you go to the call that somebody's grass clippings are on their driveway from their neighbor, you know, if you acted like you did at the trauma, we got a problem here, right? And I'm not saying that that's good or helps with your mental health of dealing with the process, but it's reality. That's what we have to do. So compartmentalization is real. So the danger is if we just kind of jam it over there into a box and never deal with it. And again, dealing with it doesn't mean we lay it all out on the table and talk about it. The success rate for exposure therapy is 11%, according to the VA. I'm no mathematician, but that sounds pretty low to me. In fact, when Prozac first came out, a doctor named Dr. Bessel van der Kolk did a study on Prozac, and he took, I don't remember the numbers, but he took like 200 people that were dealing with depression. He gave half of them Prozac and half of them a placebo, just a sugar pill. Of course, both groups got better. We know that because of a placebo effect. But the placebo group got 44% of them indicated that their symptoms were better. So if you're doing exposure therapy, which is laying it all out, talking about it over and over and over and over again, and the success rate is 11%, you're being beat out by a sugar pill by 4 times. So we don't do that. There is a place for things like exposure therapy. If you're afraid of an elevator and you just took a job on the 30th floor, we got to get you in the elevator. So we're going to take you to the elevator. We'll push a button on the elevator. Tomorrow, hold the door open. You can look in the elevator. Next day, we'll try to get in it and ride a floor, right? That's exposure therapy. But what we found through significant brain scans was that when you're just reliving the story over and over again, you're just re-traumatizing yourself. The same part of the brain kicks off as if you're dealing with it. Now, there are some people that do get better with exposure therapy. There is a percentage in there. So I don't want to knock it completely, but there's so much better effective ways. And because of brain scans and brain science, we know what's going on. So back to the compartmentalization question. If we're just jamming it all over there in whatever that looks like for somebody, and we're just holding that all in, on the trauma side, you're creating quite the mess of raw nerves. And some of it's going to come back, and it's going to leave you feeling, what I said before, helpless, hopeless, and not good enough. That's the ones that get stuck. On the kind of worldview side, maybe not as much trauma. On the worldview side, it starts to change the filter that you have for people around you. Now there's some reality to, hey, I just did a 10-hour shift and dealt with three horrible calls, and I come home and the first thing my wife asked me is, you know, did I pay the mortgage this month? Right? None of us want to make any more decisions. We're tired. We want to get out of our uniform. There's some communication you can do for that. But why is it that way? Why is it that way? Well, one, I've spent 10 hours making split second decisions, going up and down in emotion and adrenaline all day long. I'm tired and I don't want to deal with the mortgage. Okay, that's a communication thing we can work on. But what if my filter has become nothing else matters? One of the tricks about trauma is trauma makes other things seem irrelevant. People will talk to me all the time about memory loss, and they don't feel like they can remember as much as they could. And they don't really care that other stuff is going on. They can't feel emotion. Well, trauma makes everything else feel irrelevant. So if we're just packing away trauma constantly, that compartmentalizing, and again, the opposite of this is not to sit and talk about your feelings all day. We have ways to deal with this. But if I'm just compartmentalizing that all day long, everything else becomes irrelevant. Even the stuff you deem as important, like your two little girls, who you don't show much love to anymore, and you don't feel it when they come up and hug you and yell dad, right? I deal with that all the time in my office. So that's the danger to it. You know, it makes everything else irrelevant. And another trick about trauma is trauma makes the past present. Your brain does not know the difference if that event happened yesterday or a year ago. Part of your brain does. The prefrontal cortex, the thinking part of the brain, knows, oh, that was 3 years ago. We're safe. We're good. I'm whole. We're okay. I'm recovered. That limbic system, that fight or flight part of the brain, that amygdala is the smoke alarm. And all it needs is a little bit of smoke and the whole thing will kick off, right? And then you go into limbic system, into fight or flight mode. And now you might as well be in the middle of the trauma. Maybe not reliving it as such as a visual, but all the senses come back. The hopeless, the helpless, the not good enough comes back. So that would be, to me, the dangers of consistently pushing stuff down. Now, most civilians see between 1.5 to 2 critical events in their life. An officer will see between 750 and 800. Well, that tells me two things. One, we're pretty badass because we keep going. Two, it's not the trauma that's the problem. Because if the trauma was the problem, you'd quit on day two when your brain couldn't handle it anymore. So why among these 800 do some of them stick out more than others? Well, some of that's easy. A hurt kid, an innocent victim, you know, a shooting you were involved in. Those are pretty easy. But that's not what always comes in my office. You know, what comes in my office is this call. I'm so strong at work, but I can't get past this call. I'm a mess. Well, it's not necessarily the trauma in and of itself, because we'd have quit on day two when the brain couldn't handle it anymore. Out of that 750 to 800, what's going on is that trauma, if we get down to it, if we're being really honest and we work our way down to the meaning of this trauma, it left us feeling for the first time, maybe helpless, hopeless, and not good enough. And if you already have a lifetime of that before to add to that pile, you just, the compartmentalization is triple the damage. So that's how I would describe the compartmentalization is necessary. We have to do some of that stuff, but we can cause some damage too.
Earlier, you said that when you first learned about EMDR, you were very quick to criticize it based on one video that you saw on YouTube. What did you learn from being judgmental about EMDR? I'm just using that as an example, but I'm guessing we're close to the same age, in your 40s, I'd imagine.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
What did you learn about that now in your 40s? Because I know how you must feel, and I feel as well, just in a different place mentally, how we see things, sure. How we just completely compassionate human being. I can feel it even through the fucking Zoom thing here. Mm-hmm. But what did you learn about being so quick to be so judgmental about the EMDR, and what has that changed about you? Because I know it definitely changed something about you.
Well, it was the same as policing, right? How easy it was for me. I grew up extremely poor in an urban area in a big city. And so I felt like when I got into policing, that's where I would fit in well there. These low crime or these high crime areas, low income areas, like those were in my brain, like those are my people. I'll go fit in great there. But because I had 20 years life experience growing up that way, it didn't stop me necessarily from being judgmental in those areas. So, you know, one of the things that you learn through talking through people in law enforcement is maybe this guy's not such a bad guy. He just makes really dumb decisions all the time. And he still needs to do his time for it. He still needs to go to jail and he needs to quit victimizing people, right? But it was years, if not decades, of law enforcement before I was willing to see that I don't know the whole story yet, you know, mm-hmm. not to be judgmental or quick. So I think the same lesson for me was the EMDR. It was, nope, definitely not doing that. I'm the hardcore type A angry Viking therapist, and we're not doing that fluffy stuff. And now I do the fluffy stuff. You know, we're not doing yoga or taking five deep breaths in my office. But not only that, not only did I learn not to be judgmental about it myself, but I had a key moment. I was at a seminar doing the seminar I talked about earlier, and I was working with an individual. And we'll just say he's one of those cops that everybody in the state knows. He's the cop's cop. He's huge. Everybody knows him. He's the go-to guy. He'd gotten involved in a couple of shootings, and the second one just wasn't settling with him. Well, he was having some anxious stuff going on. Even to the point of a little bit of paranoia. And he doesn't mind me telling the story. And so he's this big guy. He's a type A, like even more type A than me. He's this hardcore country, you know, cop guy. Everybody knows he's a big, tough guy. Played football when he was in college. And I've got him in the room. And for the first time in mental health, I'm feeling a little bit intimidated because, like, I look up to this guy, you know, always did. It's like the cop's cop. And he's this big guy and he's all country and he's, and in my mind, I'm thinking like, he's not going to want to hear this EMDR stuff. Like, you know, that I'm going to move my, you know, have his eye movements or sounds or this thing's going to fix this trauma. And I spent like 30 minutes explaining EMDR. Hey man, this is how it works. It really is brain science and it really does work. And here's my credentials and here's how I know it works. Like 30 minutes thinking I need to talk him into this weird, you know, thing. And eventually he just said, hey, Trevor, I need some help. Can we just try it? And I'm like, oh, yeah, let's go right now. And it was amazing. It was life-changing for him. I have such a cool story about him. But it was life-changing for him. So that was the other thing of not only was I kind of skeptical or judgmental seeing it myself, but then I get trained in this great thing that I see change people's lives every day in my office or on the online program. And some days I was still like, well, I got to explain this weird stuff to you and let you know that it's real. And what I've learned over the years is don't judge that either, because people are coming in for a reason and they just want some help. You know, if you told them about foot tremor training, they may try it, you know, but just because by the time they get to me, especially those that are in public safety or military, you know, very, very, very few people come in of like, hey, I'm doing okay. It was rough. I'm doing okay. I just want to maintain being okay for my family. That's very few calls for me. Mostly it's, I need help now. I needed help 2 years ago. I need help now. So, you know, it helped me be less judgmental about what other people were thinking about it too.
Earlier, you were talking about your type A and, you know, you knew better. And then it sounded like you were talking about how you began to understand and maybe start to emphasize or display signs of vulnerability. Did you have a problem with vulnerability earlier in your life?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So especially I used to be a real small guy, and it's kind of an interesting story how I got into weightlifting and bodybuilding. But it wasn't necessarily an inadequacy. Yeah, it wasn't an inadequacy per se. But I didn't want to be vulnerable. That was a vulnerable spot for me. I can't say that I was bullied or anything. You know, we moved a lot. So that when I was a kid, so that, you know, caused some like introvertness probably, but I can't say that I was bullied or anything, but, you know, got into law enforcement. I was in EMS for 4 years before I got to law enforcement, you know, was enjoying the job, but the vulnerability to me was anytime I felt like I couldn't control the situation, you know, and in policing job, you're never 100% in control. You can raise the percentage of control, you know, be good at your tactics, know your stuff. When can you go in? When can you put this person in handcuffs? how to safely search a vehicle, right? You can raise the percentage, but you're never 100% in control. So when I would feel less in control, that was a vulnerability for me, not really in the way of not feeling like somebody was letting me be in charge. You know, one of the things that you teach, you get out of that car, you're in charge of that scene. You don't have to be mean about it, but you've got to take over this scene, that you're here to do a job. So it wasn't disrespect. It wasn't a level of not letting me do my job as the police, but the out of controlness sometimes I think would be a vulnerability. So if I carried one through public safety into mental health, you know, here I was a rookie again after 15 years of not being a rookie anymore. Here I was a rookie again. So there was some vulnerability there, but in the same way that I got better at policing and less vulnerable was training and tactics and education and understanding and time, same thing in mental health, you know, training and tactics and for what those are in mental health and education and putting in the time. So I don't feel so vulnerable anymore. And where it's really served me is, you know, just this week, I flew towards the West Coast for a big incident that ended the life of an officer. And they called us and they were like, you know, we're out there for a job. We're out there for a class. We're out there trying to help with this too. I show up one morning, got coffee in hand, still kind of waking up because it's a 3-hour time difference. And, you know, I'm still trying to get moving. And they're like, hey, we need you to work with this guy. He's in pretty tough shape. Do you think you can do that? And I'm like, yeah, sure. Bring him in, man. We'll hit him around lunch. You know, see what I can do. And they're like, oh, it's him. This guy sitting right here, you know. And before that would have been like, oh, geez, you know, maybe some vulnerability there. But the same way that you get strong at policing, you know, even listening to guys like what you were doing, getting better at education and what you can do in law enforcement, same thing happened to me. So that reduced that vulnerability. We took him right back to a private room and we had him in great shape in 20 minutes. You know, it was great. Whereas that vulnerability, what maybe not is there anymore by what, like I said, what you guys are doing, tactics and training and education and experience, then you don't have to go invulnerable anymore. You kind of know what to do.
I think I know who the guy was that you were talking about, the big buff dude, but I'm going to say it after the podcast is over because I'm curious, because the guy that I was thinking of, I'm extremely fond of. I think he's a gift to the world. You know, listen, yeah. I'm extremely fond about just about everybody, to be honest with you.
Fair.
And sometimes when I see people misbehaving towards our company, especially when you're saying that we're on the same team, you know, I wonder, where's the hurt? Why are they acting that way? What's the pain? What's causing the anxiety to react and behave towards us, who essentially has the same intention that you do? And it goes real deep. I really started to think about, like, how deep does that go? Kicking their butt behind the scenes? What is kicking their butt behind the scenes? You know,
well, go back to the last subject, vulnerability, right? Like there are, I'll be the first to admit, you know, I'm still new in the business world. And the one thing they don't teach you in mental health is how to do business. I've made all this up myself. It's gone well. I've had good mentors. I've sought out people that knew what they were doing. I've read all the books. I've done all the podcasts. It's gone well. But who you talk about vulnerability, you know, as a business owner, you know all too well, it's an up and down thing. So I will, not so much anymore, but especially early days, you know, when I didn't think things were going as well, I'll see somebody else doing well and think, well, you know, I want to come up with a reason why they're doing well better than me. You know, not so much when I was 20, like when I was 21 trying to do that stuff, but yeah, it happens. And so I spent some time. My online program, especially, but the office is not necessarily based for police. It's just who I tend to attract. You know, they're my people. So that's who I tend to attract, military, public safety. And so a lot of my posts are about that because I think that's an underserved area, you know, that I have specific knowledge in. And there's not a day goes by I don't get attacked or called a bootlicker or, you know, oh, you just love the blue or, and I considered myself fairly aggressive in law enforcement, but also willing to not sweat the small stuff. You know, if somebody was saying something or but try to save it for the big things. But man, these people get under my skin. And so I'll tell them, they don't know what they're talking about. I'm going to tell them. And so I'd get in an argument, you know, which is ridiculous, you know, online. And I got to the point where, and maybe this is not a good story, but I got to the point where if they would say something like F you and F the police and, you know, all this stuff, I would literally on Instagram just hit video chat, see if they'd answer. Let's have a chat about it. I really wasn't going to scream at them or yell at them. You know, I was going to go the therapist route of like, dude, what is so bad in your life? You know, like what, man, that's a lot of hate you got going on there. Well, in like the 15, 20 times I tried this, I screen recorded it and nobody ever answered. So apparently Instagram doesn't think that's as funny as I do. So I actually got banned for a little while for that one. They took my page down. So can't do that anymore.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Let me give you some advice from a business person. There are far better things to do with your time than to fight with people online. Now,
yes.
Why I say this is, I don't know if you've ever heard of a guy named Andy Frisella.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yep. Okay, so I went to an event called Agent 2021 years ago in Miami, Florida, and he gave a speech. And you know, I wish I actually knew more about Andy at the time, because after that, I really got into his podcast and thought he was just really said some things that changed my life. Mm-hmm. And they're not the most profound things in the world. It's actually more business advice for me that gave me more direction and path and mapped it out for me more. But he said, all of you in this audience are so fucking worried about the 50% of people that don't like you. Mm. Why don't you start worrying about the 50% of people that do like you and give them your time, energy, and effort?
That's pretty good.
So, man, learning how to shun the non-believers is a superpower. I mean, we get destroyed on TikTok, but I would be doing a disservice to my cause to be taking the energy that I have only so much per day or this lifetime and giving to anybody who doesn't deserve it. Who does deserve it? The men and women in law enforcement who are desperate for help. And that's it. So that's how I spend my day. Now,
I've got a saying now, because what I had to learn was, why do I care about that, about the quality of that people? Because who's saying it? And so I've got a saying now that I don't take fitness advice from a dude with titties, and I don't take policing advice from somebody farting on their grandma's couch. That's what they're doing.
No, there's no question about it. And you know what? This may sound a little judgmental, but I am really convinced that 95% of the world is just inadequately unintelligent. So when I see something, I go, law of averages right there. So this is what I'm dealing with here. And I have theories and people tend to want to fight with me about these, but I also find low intelligence goes hand in hand, it seems to be, with low EQ, low emotional control. Now, as a therapist, you don't have to respond to that, but the most flying off the handle, emotional, crazy people that I've known, I shouldn't use that word, I know, are typically very unintelligent as well. I don't know if that's built from frustration, not understanding or processing, but there's no question about it. So, but on the other spectrum, it doesn't mean because you're of high intelligence, you have good EQ either. But I see that constantly. I think about the people who I know that have very, very short tempers, misbehave constantly, act out, lash out, you know, schoolyard battles, this bullshit. Mm-hmm. And I go, but I know they're some of the dumbest people I've ever met in my life. Now it's time for me. This is now called selfish den time. Okay. Because what's your workout routine like?
So I'm an early riser. I've always been one that likes to get it out before the day starts, because I will consistently tell myself, oh, I'll do it after work. It's right down the street. You know, I live in a smaller community now. And every time I do that, A, I'm either too tired because I've been doing this for 10 hours. You know, that the one of the tricky things I say about mental health as a therapist, and really in policing this fits too, is it's 10 hours of a job interview. I mean, it's just constant.
Brutal, man. Thinking.
Yeah, it's constant thinking, just like policing is, right? So I hit it in the morning because I know if I don't, part of me is, and as a business owner, you know this, I have too many irons in the fire, way too many, you know. So I'm a professor at a college for you know, graduate and PhD level counselors. You know, I work for a nonprofit out of Vegas called the Wounded Blue that helps injured officers.
Oh, bro, listen.
I'm their clinical
director. I just found out about those guys at the tent city in Washington, D.C.
Oh, yeah. I was there. Yep.
I think I saw you there, dude.
I was at their tent. Yeah, I was at their tent this year. Yep.
See, I guess I'm not that memorable, Dr. Trevor Wilkins, but we did speak there.
You look like every cop. You know, I don't anymore. I used to.
We did. We had a tent there. Our company had a tent there. And I went there and I was talking to the women that were working the tent. I'm like, look, just take my money. Just they're like, well, you want shirts? Nice. I'm like, nah, I don't. You can give me a shirt if you want, but just take my money. Because I'm thrilled to help. I know exactly who you, I did. You know, it's funny. I'm looking at you. I'm going, I know I've met you before somewhere.
That's it, man. Yeah. I was at the, I was there. And then 3 years ago, which was the last Police Week Tent City, I was there for them as well. But yeah, we were there most of the day.
Yeah. I remember dude. There was another dude there as well, right? With you guys.
Oh yeah. Yeah. So Randy Sutton is the president. He's a former Las Vegas Metro lieutenant that retired, kind of got screwed on his pension and had to fight for it. And that's why he started it. But Randy's all over. He's been in movies. If you watch any of the cops in the 90s and 2000s in Vegas, Randy's on it.
All right. Here's my next one. That's for Dennis and maybe some other people listening. The books behind you. As soon as we got on this thing, Trevor, I saw the 10X rule. I have listened to that book because I don't read. I only read case law. I've listened to that book 5 or 6 times. What'd you think of it?
Mm-hmm. I like it. I like it because it is not, it wasn't a technical business book. And that's what I thought it was going to be. I got to listening to Grant Cardone when I'd started the online program, and it turns out I'm a pretty good therapist, terrible salesman. I never really wanted to be a salesman. I don't want to sell people. I don't want to talk people into the things they don't need or take their money unnecessarily, but I wasn't doing a good job articulating why I thought it would help. It's a great program. I literally get text messages on the daily through that program. This changed my life. I read one on there yesterday. 2 days of this, I'm already a better person because I'm thinking more clearly, you know, because I'm there to change your filter, not make you work out. Like it's all encompassing. But I just wasn't a good job of telling that. And I'm a fairly intimidating, aggressive guy, but I don't like to be a bragger either. Kind of what you're talking about with the dual workouts. Like, I don't mind telling people that stuff because maybe they'll go, oh, that's what I need to do. But I don't want to brag either. So I had a lot of trouble. So I knew Grant Cardone. I probably found him on Instagram or something, you know, and I liked what he had to say. And I actually ended up signing up for his Cardone University and really trucked through all his lessons. It was a little different because my sales is different. It's me as opposed to a product or, you know, but it really, not only did it help me learn to talk to people for that, but it changed some of the way that I talk to people as a whole, even in my office. You know, I don't have to sell people in the office. They came in for a reason. You know, they're willing to give their hourly pay or their insurance card and their copay or whatever. But, you know, the online thing's a little different animal, just as you know all too well. And it even changed the way that I talk to people when they're upset about something, you know, so that one was pretty influential for me. And like I said, I actually read his other one first. Is it Seller Be Sold?
Yep. Seller Be Sold, one of them.
So I read that one first and it's a little more technical. And then I got onto this one and it's more mindset, which is that's my game. You know, I'm a mindset guy, not a fake mindset guy, but you know, your mindset is what changes everything. It is your filter. So that's why I like that one.
Also, I think I see 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. Is that one too? Is there?
Yep. That's a good one. Yep.
Best Stephen part of the Covey, book for me was the subway, the paradigm shift in the subway. I talk about that in this podcast. Oh, yeah. That was a big unlock for me. I should read it in my courses.
Yep. I need to go through that one again. These are not always my current books. They're just ones that, you know, I kind of want people to see and maybe they're interested in. I've got a couple more, but it's currently, you know, life isn't always what it seems with technology. I've got 2 of them holding up my laptop to get it closer to the camera. So
what are your top 1 to 3 favorite books that you've ever read? And we're going to discuss the 10X rule so we can move on to something else. But what are the 1 to 3 books that you, and again, it could be in for no reason, just the stuff that spoke to you.
So up here is a 3-Minute Therapy by Dr. Gil. Almost said his name wrong.
Gil Martin, is that who it is?
Edelstein. That's who I almost said. Dr. Edelstein and Steele. 3-Minute Therapy. So my primary, we talked about EMDR, my primary therapy modality is called rational emotive behavior therapy. And it has to do with the fact that it's not what happens to us that matters. It's how we feel about the incident, how we filter that incident, right? And that doesn't mean we're going to make bad things good or fake happy, but it is our filter, our basic beliefs that change everything. Somebody stealing from me cannot make you angry. It can't. It's a thing that happened. I'm angry because I've decided this person is a piece of crap and they're no good and they can't do this to me and they're a horrible person and now I'm angry. Now I'm not going to change that to, it's okay you stole from me, buddy. No, but I got to be rational about it. I don't know if he's a bad person or not. He's bad in this, and I think he should go to jail for it. I can't make irrational demands. You can't steal from me. Well, he just did, dummy. So, like, I don't want you to. I wish you wouldn't. I desire you not to. That's the tenet of rational behavior therapy. Well, Dr. Edelstein studied directly under the creator of RBT, Dr. Albert Ellis, who I really wish I could have met and trained under, but he passed away in the mid-2000s. I have the very, very fortunate that I got to train under people that trained under him directly. But that one's really good because it kind of lays out the understanding of REBT and takes you through some exercises. And what people find is with REBT is, no, I don't agree with that. I don't agree with that. Oh, shoot. Suddenly it makes sense. You know, it changed my life. EMDR changed my life, but so did rational motor behavior therapy. So 3-minute therapy is very good. They have a real short podcast that they do on YouTube as well. So that one's very different. And the second one I kind of have to put into a category, and that was Stoic philosophy. You know, whether it's learning to be a Stoic or how to live like a Stoic or the lives of the Stoic, I think is the red one up there. Ryan Holiday is an excellent author when it comes to that. Stoic philosophy is what created rational motor behavior therapy. Dr. Ellis even has recordings where he said that. He was doing psychoanalysis, which was the Freudian way, thought it was very stupid because it is. And so he says he went back to his childhood love of Stoic philosophy and created REBT. So my right arm is full of Viking tattoos. My left arm is all Stoic philosophy. So
cool, man.
Those are the things that really changed my life. That's how important it is to me. So anything Stoic about that, you know, is pretty important. For a third one, I don't know if I can come up with a title. I enjoy reading all different types of education and mindset. So I enjoy reading Jordan Peterson. I will say I don't always agree with everything that he says. But the thing I like about guys like Jordan Peterson is he backs up what he says with science and facts. Same thing with the Ben Shapiros of the world. You know, you may not agree with them and you don't have to, and maybe they're wrong, but they back up what they say by facts with IQ, not EQ, like you said before. Mm-hmm. When you go to emotional, you've lost me. You've lost me. Be passionate about what you want. I'm very passionate about helping public safety and military and, you know, adults with childhood trauma, but I don't have to scream about it either. You know, that's when you lose that. That's when the recordings of cops start happening. You know, when you've gone to emotional instead of tactical.
I want to convey this message, and I'm going to speak on behalf of Dr. Trevor and myself. When you stand for something and you're going to take a position on what you think's important, you're going to be challenged and tried. And boy, you better stand tall. You better stand strong and do your best to stay upright. You guys who are listening probably don't have much context, but in the off-camera, behind-the-scenes realm, we get our butts kicked. Just the way it goes.
Sure.
But it's worth it. And I just want to give everybody a piece of advice that if you're going to tell or get behind some kind of cause or topic or purpose, is to, when the going gets tough, stick it the fuck out, because I'm going to tell you, on the other side of it is going to be a major unlock in your life. And whatever you want to, however you want to quantify what that unlock is, whether it's through admiration or wealth, whatever it may be, it'll be worth it. And you'll be thankful. So,
and you don't know the end. When I look back on my life, I'm 43. I was supposed to be a captain by now with my own post, you know, right off into the sunset after 25 years. You know, like that was my life. All I ever was going to be was a cop's what I wanted to be. And that was taken away from me pretty much overnight. You know, I lost a lot of things that, like I said, I call those dark years. I lost a lot of things. And if you'd have told me 10 years ago or 15 years ago when I was in law enforcement that I'd be a doctor, a therapist, you know, mental health specialist, whatever, I'd have laughed in your face, laughed in your face. I wouldn't even go see those crazy people. No way. And, here I am. So, you know, you never know what's on the side. And you sometimes make unrealistic and irrational demands of what you should be doing or where you should be. It's the should, right? That's the problem. I should be this. I should be this. I should be doing this. I should know how to do this. None of that's true, by the way. You should nothing. You know, I want to. I'd like to get better. This is a goal I have in mind, but must, shall, have to. Now you're just setting yourself up for failure, setting yourself up for anger, anxiety, and depression, because none of it's true. I should have been a captain by 43. Nope.
You know, there are variables that you can control and there are variables that you can't control. Mm-hmm. And you do your very best. And just like myself, there's a lot of admiration on top of or side by side with a lot of anger towards what we're doing. But, you know, I sometimes even have to talk to our instructors here and they're like, you know, this weird blah, blah, blah. I'm like, well, yeah, dude, it may sound crazy, but you guys really are having impact and actually changing the course of things. Who on God's green earth would have ever said to a kid who took his first civil service test when he was 18, you're looking at him here, that, hey, you're going to head one of the largest police training companies in the country, if not the largest, or going to be the largest in a fucking blink of an eye. And, you know, you're going to be regarded as this national figure that's actually helping law enforcement become better. I would have said, you're fucking nuts.
Right. Oh, right? Yeah.
But I'm down for it. And I don't know where I'll be in 10 years, but it's been an absolute pleasure. And I'll take the lashes because I know what it's doing for people on the other end. Absolutely. Of things.
Yep. And I've quit guessing. I just keep charging forward.
That's it, man.
Whether it's charging forward in my own mental health, because just because I'm where I'm at and just because things are really good in my life compared to those dark years, doesn't mean I got it all figured out. I still do dumb stuff. Wow. You know, I still do dumb stuff. And so I've quit. I'm still a tactics guy. I'm still a planner, but I've quit trying to figure out what the end is. I have a goal. I have some things I'd like to accomplish, but I've quit trying to figure out the goal because it changes and I was wrong in the first place, and it's okay to be disappointed by not meeting a goal. Disappointed. I can deal with disappointed. But if I've demanded that this is the goal and this is what has to happen and I don't achieve it, that's depression and anxiety and anger and guilt instead of disappointment. Hell, I can deal with disappointment. I don't think that the point of mental health is to go from depressed to happy. It's to go from depressed to sad. Sad is a natural emotion. Go be sad. I've been sad. Not to go from we want to go from anxious to frustrated. Frustrated. I can deal with that. I used to work for the government. I know all about frustration, right? anger to frustration, anxiety to nervous, right? Okay, go be nervous. You know, people ask me all the time, I've got to go do this. How do I not be nervous about it? You can't go be nervous. You know, every time I talk to a bigger and bigger crowd, I'm a little nervous. Now, the fortunate thing I have, much like you guys, I'm sure, is I know my subject, you know, so I don't get intimidated by, you know, I don't get intimidated by questions anymore. I don't get intimidated by large groups anymore. There are definitely things I would be intimidated by. If you plop me in the middle of an eating disorder discussion, I mean, I can tell you what I remember and how it relates to trauma, but that's not my area. But these areas, this is my stuff. These are my people. So that's what I like.
And I'm comfortably ready to disengage on an area or topic that I have no business being involved in. Mm-hmm. Literally.
Now
I'm
like,
I'm talking to the wrong guy. Want to go to Fourth Amendment search and seizure? I'm your dude. Let's rock and roll.
Yeah.
Right? Houses, cars, people. Let's do it.
Yep.
Dr. Trevor Wilkins, where can people find you and your website and anything else that you have resources that are available?
Yep. So I tell people, or you'll get the most information is Instagram, and it's just at Dr. Trevor Wilkins, Dr. Trevor Wilkins. That one my people keep up the most. That also translates into the Facebook, which is just Dr. Trevor Wilkins, the Angry Viking Therapist. To find out about the online program, it's theangryvikingtherapist.com. So if people are interested in that or just want to get a little more information, the other place that I tell people to go if they're not an Instagram person is YouTube. I do put out, you know, as many as I can. As many of us know, I need to do more that work in this industry. But I get a lot of compliments on the YouTube stuff, which is just the Angry Viking Therapist, if you'll search it. I get a lot of compliments on it because, again, as I said earlier, a lot of people will say, man, it's like you're talking about me. Like, man, I'm talking about myself. If you knew my story of a fall from being, a multiple decorated for bravery in the line of duty officer to the worst employee you could ever have, working for you all because of PTSD, you'll realize I'm not talking about me. I am talking about me. I'm talking about a vast majority of us, because it's not necessarily, I can't stop thinking about an incident. I can't stop thinking about this. I can't stop having nightmares. I can't go back to work. That's what we teach PTSD is. That's not what comes to my office. What comes to my office is I'm sad. I'm drinking too much. My family's falling apart. I've become the worst employee you could actually work with. I'm doing things I shouldn't be doing in high risk. Again, my marriage is falling apart. I'm losing everything. I can't do this job anymore. That's what it really looks like. So I try to impress that stuff upon the YouTube side, because, you know, they're 10 minutes. I'm a short attention span kind of guy. So those are the best ways, through the Instagram, Dr. Trevor Welkins, the YouTube's The Angry Viking Therapist. TheAngryVikingTherapist.com is the website to get a little information about that. If people kind of interested in reaching out, getting a little more formal, you know, in some kind of work with me. But that's where I tend to be found.
You are the man, and I think we'll be friends for a while. Got a funny feeling.
I'm good with that. Yep.
On behalf of the law enforcement community, thank you for being here with us today and sharing your time. And I appreciate everybody's continued support for Street Cop training, and check out StreetCop.com. I'll see you guys. Guys, if you're in an area where you're trying to get to our classes, but we're not close to you, fret not. We actually have on-demand training at StreetCop.com. You can take that course online right now, and then you could attend that training in the future at no additional cost. You can redeem your voucher, so you get two for the price of one. We don't want to deny you the ability to take this training now, especially knowing that it can keep you safe, at a very minimum, putting bad guys in jail where they belong, and at the maximum, going home to your family. Check out StreetCop.com for that offer.